Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the voices from this week's headlines.
The plan is intended for the benefit of New Hampshire, so we hope that other individuals, groups, businesses, and elected officials, policy leaders, will embrace pieces of it or sections of it and help us move the ball forward.
The state is doing better now than it was last year. However, Nielsen says, employment seems to have stalled over the last few months.
It's been kind of either at 5% or at 5.1%, so you can maybe say we kind of plateaued a little bit at that level at the moment.
When a small New Hampshire brewer started making a darker-than-usual roast, it used that name, Charbucks, and this got the attention of its much larger rival.
Starbucks didn't seem to like the attention and sued Black Bear Micro Roastery back in 2001, arguing the Charbucks label would confuse consumers and dilute Starbucks' more recognizable brand.
I think of poetry reading as a practical thing to do. It gives us some experience in the art of just being. I would even say that it allows us to love more and better.
Every time we put forward a compromise, we are told that it's no good. It's still their original plan.
Because I think what you're doing is you're creating Medicaid expansion in the state of New Hampshire, and the public does not want an entitlement program coming into the state and keep living on.
From the top, that was Business and Industry Association President Jim Roach on the BIA's release of its strategic economic plan. NHPR's Emily Corwin reporting on a new state unemployment number. Morning Edition hosts Renee Montaigne and Steve Inskeep talking about a legal victory for a local coffee roaster. New Hampshire's new poet laureate, Alice Fogle, in a 2009 word-of-mouth interview. And Governor Maggie Hassan and Senate President Chuck Morse on the breakdown of talks on Medicaid expansion. The legislative wrangle over Medicaid was one of the most closely watched stories of the week. After a long debate at the Statehouse earlier this year, 3 months of summer meetings by a special commission, and a 2-week special session on this topic, the State House and Senate in the end came away with no deal, leaving the issue for debate in January 2014. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. We want your thoughts about these headlines and others. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests for this week's roundup are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. And Jeff, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Nice seeing you, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks as always.
Hi, good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Ben Lubsdorf, staff reporter at the Concord Monitor, covering New Hampshire politics and state government. And Ben, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Ben, I want to turn to you first, Medicaid and this breakdown at the last minute in the final days of this special session. Were you surprised that after all this, they were unable to reach a deal?
Well, I think there was a real, yes, I think on some level it was very surprising because we started off this process way back in February when Governor Hassan presented her budget, and the budget included Medicaid expansion. The debate peaked in June when it wasn't included in the budget, but everyone agreed to study the issue. And all throughout this process, folks on both sides have said, we want to make a deal. We want to make a compromise. We want to expand access to health care. Now, do you do that through traditional Medicaid? Do you do it through private insurance? Do you do it through some combination? That was where the debate was. That's where the negotiations were. But both sides seemed real committed to making an effort to do this. There wasn't a lot of folks in their trenches firing at each other from a distance. So in a sense, them not coming to a deal is not what leadership on either side wanted. But yeah, on the other side, it's not that surprising because there are some pretty stark ideological differences here, and that was reflected in the two major plans. The Democratic plan that used managed care organizations, the current form of Medicaid, to expand health care, and the Senate plan, which used private insurance through the exchanges. And the one of the big sticking points between them was, how quickly do you transition people into that private insurance? How fast is it practical to transition people? And they just couldn't get over that hump. It was Wednesday when both sides sort of threw up their arms and said, we're not going to make a deal. And it was yesterday that the House and Senate met, and the Senate didn't pass any plan at all. The House did after 4.5 hours of debate and a lot of Republican delaying tactics. And then the Senate killed that plan.
Yeah,
everyone went home.
I have to say, I was kind of surprised, Dean Spiliotis, because Ben's right. All throughout this, various people on various sides have said, you know, if we could just do it this way, maybe we can work it out. And if we can just find a New Hampshire solution. And there did seem to be a lot of interesting approaches to this. But in the end, I guess that hump Ben talks about was too big.
Yes. You know, and we've been talking about this issue here every Friday for months now. And I've always been a little bit more skeptical than perhaps some other people, because, as Ben said, there are some real fundamental underlying ideological differences between the two sides. You know, I read a lot of the sort of press coverage and it says, well, this is just a debate over the timeline, and Democrats want to stretch out the timeline a little bit more than Republicans. But it's really about a lot more than that. It's about a fundamental disagreement about the role of the federal government in forcing states to take on mandates that they might not otherwise want to take on. So, you know, and Republicans are in an interesting position because on the one hand, a lot of them want to scuttle Obamacare. They prefer not to have it at all. On the other hand, they see that there is a need for this in the state at some level. So they're going to kind of dig in their heels when it comes to how it's actually implemented. They would prefer to have it go to the private sector, to the marketplace, but the marketplace has been problematic so far because we're part of that healthcare.gov national marketplace. So I've always thought there was a real possibility that it was going to be pushed over into January. Whether that was intentionally strategic move by Republicans or simply just because there are disagreements, I'm not surprised in the end. The other thing that was interesting was the extent to which this all became politicized in recent days. Maggie Hassan made some comments at the Jefferson Jackson dinner on Saturday. She said that there no plan would be better than the Republican plan. And then she also traveled around the state giving speeches and sort of to kind of leverage a little pressure on the state senators. As soon as that stuff starts to happen, you can guarantee Republicans are going to dig their heels in. So she may feel justified in the sense that they felt that Democrats put forth their best compromise. But nonetheless, I've thought all along that kind of when you get down to actually making a move on something like this, the ideological differences and the sort of fundamental dislike conceptually for the Obamacare mandates among Republicans, it's a big sticking point. Now, you can opt in on any quarter. So this will come back up in January and they can decide to opt in at that point.
Well, yeah. One more quick question for you, and then I do want to go to Jeff. So are you saying, Dean, that Governor Hassan made a mistake, that in the waning days of this special session, she got a little too political and that upset Republicans and they decided forget it? Is that what you're saying?
I think a couple things are going on. I think part of it was sort of a genuine frustration on her part that Democrats had made a good faith effort to compromise, that this is a golden opportunity to get some federal dollars and to serve a population in the state that's underserved. It's also a very common practice by chief executives, whether it's a governor or a president, to use sort of the power and leverage of the office to try to get members of the legislature to kind of go along, put a little pressure on your home turf. So there's nothing wrong with what she did, but it's a high risk strategy because it always runs the risk of alienating members of the party. And that seems to be what happened. If you look at the statements from Republican senators after her visits to their home turf, they were not happy with it.
Yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, it's funny. I think on one level, it gave them an excuse. If you heard Senate Majority Leader Bradley, he basically pointed to this. She went to the districts instead of just talking to the senators. And I know that Senator O'Dell, who's one of the senators who was targeted, you know, she went over to the Upper Valley in his area to kind of get to beat the drum for this thing. And I guess it seems as if his nose was out of joint. And you know, it makes you realize that, you know, a lot of these Republican senators in particular miss the old days of John Lynch, I think, because that was not his the way he operated. I do want to say one other thing about this whole thing about the marketplace. There is no marketplace in New Hampshire. There's one insurer on the marketplace. And I think that when the governor and the supporters of the expansion say, you know, why don't we wait a little bit, because there is a hope that there will be at least one other insurer on that marketplace in a couple of years. It seems as if it will be, because right now the New Hampshire health insurance system is just a mess. We lost MVP has left to go back to New York. It's not going to be here anymore. There are really very few health insurance companies And that is a concern.
Well, Jeff, you're the business reporter, so you know this better than me. But Anthem would say, hey, yes, we're the only company, but we do have 11 plans to choose from. So that's marketplace-y,
that. But they're competing with themselves. It's not the same as real competition.
And Harvard Pilgrim is coming in next year, everybody hopes.
That's what the hope is, 2015. Now, the other thing is that, you know, the BIA, the Business and Industry Association, came out last week or so calling for Medicaid expansion, which I thought was, you know, I guess Dean was saying, I guess I was being naive, but I thought maybe that would just give some kind of cover for one or two of the Republican senators to say, you know, this is something the business community wants, but they didn't do it, and it was really very interesting.
Ben, go ahead.
One interesting dynamic that emerged over the last couple of weeks was that while Jeb Bradley were negotiating, were trying to make a deal, they were taking a lot of fire from the right wing, from groups that were and activists who are very opposed to any form of implementing Obamacare. And in the end, Maggie Hassan may have been going around to districts hoping to peel off a few moderate Republican votes for this plan. In the end, the Republican caucus split, but it wasn't on the left. It was on the right. It was three senators of their 13 who wouldn't support their leadership's own plan. That made sure that the Senate couldn't pass a plan, and it really reduces the leverage the Republicans had in these negotiations. They couldn't even bring a majority of the Senate along with them. That made perhaps more appealing to the Democrats the prospect of peeling off a few votes and passing a plan more to their liking than giving the Republicans everything they wanted.
One last – oh, go ahead, Jeff.
I just want to say there was an article in yesterday's New York Times about this memo in the House among the House Republicans, and it was basically saying this is a national strategy on the Republican Party to just oppose everything about the Affordable Care Act that they possibly can, and
state by state,
and this, you know, this is just part of what's been going on nationally. You know, we're not unique in New Hampshire.
Okay, so quick preview of January, Dean. What's it going to be like when they take this up again?
Boy, it's going to be interesting. I mean, a lot of it's going to depend on the extent to which, as I think Ben pointed out quite nicely, the divisions within the Republican Party can kind of be closed a little bit. I see the argument that it's about the timeline, but again, I think that there's going to have to be some movement on both sides to agree, I don't know, maybe split the difference in terms of the timing.
All right. Well, speaking of January, that is when a primary happens to fill the seat for the late executive counselor, Ray Burton. So we'll catch you up on that in just a moment. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match their employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Stonewall Farm, a nonprofit working farm and education center. Chesterfield Road, Keene, hosting their 13th annual farm fair today and tomorrow. Information at stonewallfarm.org. From Palace Theater in Manchester, presenting Jim Brickman, The Magic of Christmas, featuring a blend of holiday music and entertainment, December 10th at 7, tickets at palacetheater.org. And Green Concord, a collaboration of Concord's eco-friendly business, celebrating Green Friday, November 29th. Details online at greenconcord.org. Cloudy with some rain showers today. High temperatures, low to mid-40s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. These include the downfall of a Medicaid expansion compromise, also the BIA's release of a strategic economic plan, and later on we'll find out how Granite Staters might be observing the half-century anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. You can join us with your questions and comments about some of the headlines of the week, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Dean Spiliotis, starting out with you, the race is on to fill Ray Burton's executive council seat. A lot of people saying this week, I'm in or I'm out. Let's talk first about who's in, Dean. Just the names and a little reminder of who they are, because a lot of names aren't familiar to a statewide audience.
Sure. Just for a little background, in the wake of Ray Burton's passing, Maggie Hassan called a special election. The primary is going to be January 21st. The election will be on March 11th. If there's only one candidate from each party, then that January 1st date would be the actual election. Well, I remember we talked about this last week, and none of us really had any good ideas about who was in. So the story is developing. So far, we have two Democrats, Michael Kryans, who's a Grafton County commissioner. He's been a county commissioner for 16 years. Recently, Ray Burton actually endorsed him over a Republican opponent. So he had a working relationship with Mr. Burton, and Mark Hounsell from Conway's a former state senator as well. So
former Republican state senator,
now a Democrat, yes. Right? Running as a Democrat. So two people running on the Democratic side. Republican side, nobody in yet, but Christopher Boothby is a Belknap County Commissioner, has said he's seriously looking at it, although he's not in. So right now there's no confirmed Republican candidate, but there will be. Interestingly enough, who's out? Jeff Woodburn, a Democratic state senator, often mentioned. John Gallas, a former state senator.
From Berlin.
A Republican state senator, not running. Jeb Bradley, always mentioned for every office. He's busy being state Senate majority leader. So development on the Democratic side, Republican side, to be determined.
Well, and just remind us, Ben, if you could, how big this district is. And it gives you a sense that, you know, gosh, almost anybody could jump in.
Well, exactly. It's huge. And it's 1/5 of the state's population, but it's the northern part of the state. And it's something like 2/3 of the landmass of the state. It's 108 towns. It's 4 cities. It's, as Ray Burton liked to say, it's all or parts of 7 counties. And there's only 10 counties in the state. So you've got – it's been thought of as the North Country seat on the council because Ray Burton was such a loud advocate for the North Country for so many years. But it also includes the Upper Valley. It includes part of the Lakes region. It goes through – it stretches from the Great North Woods down to Tilton. And that's a lot of territory. That's a lot of towns. And that means that the next councilor from this district, depending on how this election goes, might not be from the North Country. They could be from the Upper Valley. They could be from the Lakes region. So that would be obviously mean the North Country has not only lost a champion, but it would lose a lot of influence in terms of who's representing them.
That's really interesting. Wow, from the Great North Woods to Tilton. Tilton's, you know, practically a suburb of Concord.
It's a big district.
The interesting thing about this politically is that, you know, Councillor Burton was so dominant in that district, he very, very rarely had any opposition. The only time was when Judd Gregg wanted the seat. That was Bernie Streeter. He didn't even lose it for that. So the interesting thing is that it's always been his. Even Democrats didn't challenge him. So now there's this, like, it's a logjam has broken, and there'll be, I believe there'll be a lot of candidates, or at least there's a lot of interest among candidates, because it's what happens when one of these offices, like executive council, governor, Senate, Congress, you know, you see the primaries, you see all kinds of people coming out looking for, there's an opportunity.
Well, it'd be interesting too, Jeff, because, you know, the executive council is sometimes a springboard to higher office, either Congress or state Senate or governor. So it'd be good to see some new folks jumping in and seeing
or
who comes
out. Or some
old
faces.
Or some old faces. I wanted to ask you, Jeff, and you others as well, about a couple big economic stories that came out this week. And as you all know, this week NHPR presented a series called How We Work 5 Years Later, looking at how our labor force and our economy have changed since the recession began. So speaking of that 5-year timeline, Jeff, state employees got their first pay raise in 5 years.
Yep.
That's a reflection of how work and the workforce have changed since 2008.
And the big reflection is that in return for that pay raise, they're having to pay a higher deductible, there's going to be an effort to reduce the cost of health care on their health insurance. And that's, you know, that's just a sign of everything in every workplace today, as we well know.
A raise of 1.5% this year, 2.25% in July, 2.25% in 2015. So small raises going out over time.
Yeah, small raises, but raises nonetheless. And it has been a long time. It's been a long time for a lot of employees, not just state employees in New Hampshire, a long, long time now, which is really, it's a reflection of that. You know, even though the recession began, you know, supposedly 5 years ago, it's really had a very long-term effect in New Hampshire. It's not as dire as it was in the early 90s. That was a really disastrous recession for New Hampshire. But it is definitely everything seems stagnant in so many different sectors, especially like things like construction. And it's not, it's just, there doesn't seem to be that much movement.
Dean?
Yeah, interesting thing about that contract is, you know, when you have these types of negotiations with employee unions, one of the issues is always health care. So now the members are going to start paying health care deductibles. I think it's $500 for individual, $750 for a family, and then I think the family goes up to $1,000. So that's always a big sticking point. So to actually get that in the contract, I think, is one of the things that helped make progress.
Yeah, and the other thing about their contract is that they're also going to be able to share in the savings, which is something else that's been going on in the private sector for quite a while.
Share in the savings meaning what?
If there's any, they'll be getting incentives to cut the cost of their health of how much is paid out, you know, for wellness programs and the like. And when any savings comes, they get a split of it with the state.
All right. Well, Ben, I wanted to ask you about another major economic story this week, and that's the Business and Industry Association releasing a strategic plan for New Hampshire. This was a big deal, a big rollout. What's the scope of this plan, Ben?
It's pretty broad. This is something that they've been working on, they say, since January. They've had a lot of input from their members, from folks outside the group, and they rolled it out this week. It covers 9 subject areas, everything from energy to healthcare to fiscal policy. It makes well over 100 recommendations. Some of them are very small, stuff like pre-certifying contractors for DES contracts. Some are very large and very controversial, like making New Hampshire a right-to-work state, like cutting business taxes. It says, I believe, when practical, which I believe the BIA will take to mean soon.
Other people say think it'd be never.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the elements of this plan I think that's important to keep in mind, which is that the BIA is a lobbying group. It's a business lobbying group. It represents a certain point of view, and they were quite explicit about this at their rollout, that this is a private sector plan for improving the economy. It's not a public sector plan. It's not coming from a state agency. This is the BIA's ideas about how to improve things. BIA does a lot of lobbying at the State House, and they'll be lobbying on this. I think this will be a platform for them to try to influence policy going forward, perhaps in a more coordinated, a more cohesive way than they have in the past. They've always been very active on issues. Now they can say this is all part of our plan to improve the economy of this state. And we'll see when the legislature comes back in January where the BIA is going to be pushing first on this. But they have said they hope it's not just going to be the BIA carrying this torch, that others will jump on board.
Right. I did want to ask you about that. The BIA made it very clear that this was not just its own vision. This was a huge process, as you said, Ben, involving a lot of people from different walks of life, involving a lot of issues beyond sort of energy and health care. It also talked about the environment and cultural amenities and so forth. Why is that important, Jeff, to say, you know, yes, we were the ones who took the initiative here, but a lot of folks were involved?
Yeah, actually, I just want to say, in full disclosure, I did participate in the education section of it, and you know, for what it's worth, which included a lot of people from the education community, not members of the BIA. Which
yeah,
is
so there was this broad reach. Yeah,
they did make an attempt to do that. You know, in a lot of ways, this is basically, you know, it is the BIA agenda of well, it's not fair to say the BIA agenda. Many of the subjects, the main subjects, have been a concern to the business community at large for many years. Healthcare, energy, education, and workforce is really something that's been very concerning, especially in recent years. In terms of the funding of the university system and the like, and it was interesting to participate in it and to hear the different viewpoints. But I also have to say that there were like limitations to what you could talk about. And something that's not wasn't really mentioned in this plan, and I think it's unfortunate, but to have a real discussion about the revenue structure of the state, which it's like that's the elephant in the room, but that's not really part of this thing.
Team?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I've sort of followed this report as well. You know, I think the idea of having, you know, 100 plus recommendations, talking about the number of stakeholders, it's a way to get people to buy in. I think the idea is that there's something in there for everyone. It's just kind of a way to sort of rally people around a pro-business agenda. You know, we've talked on and off in previous months about kind of these sort of larger nagging economic issues in the state. You know, unemployment's what, 5.1% now. It's still significantly lower than national average. But you know, we are, as we discussed last week, regaining job growth, but we're now behind Massachusetts and Vermont. So these sort of longer terms about kind of the business climate. We're one of the oldest in terms of median age. I think it's 39. A lot of retirees, a lot of students with a significant amount of debt leaving the state to go elsewhere. So these are sort of larger questions that we deal with are ongoing, and I think think that, you know, the report certainly gives a lot of opportunities to address them.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. All one word, NHPR Exchange. Join us as we review some of the top headlines of the week, from the Medicaid expansion debate that ended in no deal. We've also been talking about the BIA's release of a strategic economic plan and looking at the election to fill the Executive Council seat long held by Ray Burton. You can join us on these headlines and others at 1-800-892-6477. Again, the email, exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. All one word, NHPR Exchange. And Dean, you mentioned the unemployment numbers. And Jeff, they just came out this week on Wednesday. The New Hampshire Employment Security Office says the unemployment rate for October was 5.1%, a slight increase from September. Yeah. Of 5%. How do you interpret that? Is there anything even to interpret there?
Well, really, what it is, it just shows, when I was saying about stagnation, it's not that the economy, the New Hampshire economy, is just flat, but it's been just sluggish. It's, as Dean mentioned, New Hampshire for 20 years was leading New England in job creation, and now it's in the middle of the pack, which is very unusual. It doesn't seem to be much movement in that. I guess the New England economic forecast came out and said that, you know, we should regain the jobs we lost in the recession next spring, which is great. But if you think about it, that's five lost years of job creation.
Well, and we also talked on the show Monday as part of our series How We Work, yes, that the jobs coming back aren't necessarily as high paying as the jobs.
And they're not the same. The economy has kind of restructured. You know, it's still a very strong high tech sector, manufacturing sector, but it's just not the same as it was. And that's one of the reasons why the BIA came up with the strategic plan, is because there is a concern that, you know, we're just kind of just sitting here.
You know, and I did have one more question on what Jeff just said, that the BIA, again, they, you know, took the bull by the horns. They came up with this plan. Some people, Ben, this week said, hey, why didn't the state do this? Why did a private organization have to go ahead and do it? I think Office of Energy and Planning is supposed to do it, Ben. But then some other folks said, hey, the state wasn't doing anything. At least the BIA, you know, took some action.
Yeah, I think there's a state law in the books, and I think the last four governors have not fulfilled it to have a economic plan. So it's both parties, lots of folks. And a big part of that is that Office of Energy and Planning hasn't exactly been overstaffed the last decade. So I think that that's one concern, that the state hasn't been getting in on this. On the other hand, when you have outside groups doing it, it maybe has a little more influence on policymakers who might be skeptical of a plan coming out of one particular administration, one particular office, coming out of the state bureaucracy. You've got the BIA's plan. You've got a number of studies over the last year from the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies on the broader issues here, and they were participating in the BIA's plan.
Yeah, so they provided the backup data.
The backup data, 50 economic indicators ranking New Hampshire to other states. So I think there's a lot of – the more voices you have in this, obviously, the better it's going to be.
You know, actually, I being an old timer, I remember in the mid '80s there was an effort amongst private sector group to come up with a plan, a whole strategic plan, basically for the state going forward. I think it was to 2000 or to 2010, and it was a big event at the center of New Hampshire, and Governor Sununu came in, and he had to be the speaker, and he came in and he started just lambasting him, saying, you know, this is centralized planning like they have in the Soviet Union. We don't want this stuff, so. I don't know. We haven't seen what the reaction is yet.
Well, again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. All one word. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Dean Spiliotis, a quick business story that caught everybody's attention here at NHPR because it made national news on our network, National Public Radio. Charbucks versus Starbucks.
Yeah, it's a great story. Black Bean Micro Roastery in Tuftonburg, New Hampshire. This has been a 12-year legal battle against Starbucks. I guess they have a Charbucks roast, and the people who drink coffee know that Charbucks is sometimes a kind of a amusing derogatory name for Starbucks because it's very sort of dark, almost burnt flavor to the coffee, which some people like and some people don't like. So And Starbucks apparently did a phone survey to see if people were confused by the Charbucks van versus the Starbucks brand, and they used that as evidence. But the judge said that there was not sufficient evidence to show that this confusion was an issue. So for now, anyway, the roastery can keep making its Charbucks roast. It's not clear yet what Starbucks is going to do, if they're going to continue legal action. So this is one of those sort of Davy and Goliath stories that people like to hear about.
Yeah, and as I said, made national news. Yeah. Well, and it was a long battle.
Twelve years.
I mean, again, I don't know that much about corporate name identity battles, but 12 years seems like a long time to fight about this.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not just Starbucks. We see it with a lot of companies and corporations. Anything that could affect business negatively or infringes on, you know, trademark or copyright, they very vigorously pursue, even if it's against a small local or even a regional company.
Wow. All right. Well, let's take some calls, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Actually, Ben Lubstorf, before we go to our listeners, I did want to ask you about one more business story that came before the executive council this week. Counselors said no to a proposed contract to a Massachusetts artist who was selected to paint a New Hampshire scene for a New Hampshire state building. First of all, what's this project about, Ben?
Well, so the Anna Philbrook Center is one of the buildings on the old State Hospital campus that is being repurposed to hold state offices. The renovation happened this year, and part of the money that was appropriated for that project was set aside for art for the building to decorate it. So they put out the request for bids. 13 artists, 11 from New England, submitted ideas. A committee of people who will work in the building and other state officials reviewed them. They say, you know what, we really love this plan from this Massachusetts artist to create 6 pulp paintings of the white birch tree.
What's a pulp painting?
It's, I think, a painting that's textured using pulp paper. And it images on the theme of transition, looking at the white birch, which is the official state tree, at various stages of the year. And officials like this. They took it to the executive council. It's not a lot of money. It's $12,800. But and the executive council was pretty skeptical. They said, well, we couldn't find a New Hampshire artist to paint New Hampshire's tree for a New Hampshire building. And there's apparently some legal issues. You can't say we're not going to take out-of-state bids because there's this whole constitution for the country that says you have to give an equal chance to businesses from other states. But in the end, you couldn't. It's a four-person council at the moment with Ray Burton's passing, and they couldn't get the 3 votes they needed to move this contract forward. It was 2-2, a deadlock, and that killed the contract. So now the Department of Cultural Resources needs to find someone else to do the artwork for this building.
Well, I'm sure there's a New Hampshire artist somewhere who wouldn't mind $12,000.
Well, and some of them put in bids for this project, so they might be going back to that pool.
The irony is that there's been a whole debate on the executive council of opening up the bidding process to keep costs lower, and here's an example of it working, and I guess they didn't like it, so a couple of them didn't.
Well, coming up, gentlemen, a couple more stories to follow up on, and we will also go to NHPR's Brady Carlson, who is in Dallas commemorating the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. So we'll talk to Brady in just a minute and take your questions and comments as well. Stay with us.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning. At 10 o'clock, the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show.
Do you recall the first time you met John Kennedy?
Yes, I do.
I told him, I said, Mr. Kennedy, he says, look, my name is Jack. You call me Jack.
And there he was, the President of the United States, standing on the doorstep.
I'm Robert McNeil, and the program is We Knew JFK, Unheard Stories from the Kennedy Archives, from the Public Radio Exchange.
God, I hope they don't play this for a long, long time.
We Knew JFK, this afternoon at 3 on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Pax World Mutual Funds, a leader in sustainable investing, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision-making, paxworld.com for tomorrow. And the Flying Monkey in Plymouth presenting Christmas with Natalie McMaster on December 5th and the Newtopians, a John Lennon experience, on the 6th. Tickets at flyingmonkeynh.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, we'll replay our show on the teen drinking problem in New Hampshire. Join us Monday morning at 9 for that conversation. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us right now with your questions and comments about some of the top headlines of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And as you all know, gentlemen, all week, the nation and, of course, New Hampshire have been observing the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Joining us now is NHPR's All Things Considered host, Brady Carlson. He's in Dallas for observances of this. He's actually at Dealey Plaza right now. Brady's in Dallas as part of his book with a working title called Dead Presidents, An American Adventure. It's about his visits to presidential grave sites and how we honor our presidents. Now, it's a little tricky down there, a lot of press at Dealey Plaza, so we just lost our connection with Brady Carlson. But Jeff Feingold, I want to go to you. Before the show, you were telling us what you remember about that fateful day.
As I said, as an old-timer, I was in fourth grade Mrs. Jacoby's class in PS 225 in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, and I remember the principal came into the school, into the class, and said, you know, you're being dismissed. It was about 1 o'clock, 1:30, and school ended at 3, and you could go home early. And I remember they let us out.
Did they tell you why?
No, they just basically said, you're going home. And there and I'm not being sexist about this, a sea of mothers to pick up their kids. I remember my mother was there. She was in the car, and, you know, just tears coming down everybody's face. I said, what's going on? Well, you know, what's going on? And, you know, we found out. My mother told me that, you know, told us. My brother was in the school, too, and it was almost like the time stood still for that several days after that.
Wow.
I do remember we ended up going on Monday for the funeral. There was a big service in the synagogue in Brighton, and it was as if it was the High Holy Days. It was filled with people, just adults just crying. I had never seen my father cry before, and it was just so eerie. And to think that 5 years later we went through similar things with Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy, and my generation has moments like that, and obviously September 11th is included in that.
Absolutely.
You can't forget anything about it.
What a story. Yeah. Thank you for telling us that. And Ben, even though obviously you were not born yet, your family has a connection to this story.
Yes, both my parents are reporters, and my dad was actually working for the Associated Press in D.C. at that point, and he wrote a column about this week that he was working the overnight shift, so he was napping with the radio on and kept hearing words like Dallas and shots, and so woke up and called the office and said, "Do you want me to come in?" They said, no, you're too junior. Come in later. And he's not offended because everyone was working so hard and it was such a stressful day. They wanted some fresh people coming in for the overnight shift to help cover this story from Washington. And obviously, it's one of those defining moments that for an earlier generation was Pearl Harbor, but for a later generation is 9/11, one of these moments that everyone remembers where they were, and it sort of ties the whole country together in a way that we don't usually see.
Yeah, and Dean, we're dating ourselves.
Yes.
You and I were babies, so we don't have personal reflections. But I do wonder about, you know, New Hampshire and how it's kind of thinking and feeling about this anniversary.
Yeah, as you mentioned, I was still in diapers when he was assassinated. It's interesting to me, and I think Ben touched nicely on this, that each generation has a kind of moments that are key to their self-identity. For the baby boom generation, that generation, Kennedy really kind of motivated everyone to public service. He was the first televised president, so people really started to follow politics in real time in a way that they never did before, even with the radio. In an eerie way, his assassination, I think, kind of sped up the civil rights agenda. He had been moving it forward, but as kind of in respect to him, posthumously, LBJ was able to get through the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act in 64 and 65. And it's been interesting for me as a professor to try to sort of provide relevance to a much younger generation who, you know, they sort of know he's this kind of seminal figure, but they're not really quite sure how. So I think this has been a good opportunity to introduce the Kennedy legacy to a whole new generation of younger adults.
Yeah, my son's middle school class has been talking about this all week. Well, we've been having trouble with our connection to Brady Carlson in Dallas, but we think he's with us now. Brady, you there, please?
I am there. Hi, Laura. It's nice to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Again, you're at Dealey Plaza right now. That's where everything is going to be happening today. And as I said, this is part of a book you're writing, Brady, on how we honor our presidents. What were some of the New Hampshire connections with JFK, Brady?
Well, the biggest one, I think, is in Nashua. You can find, if you head to Nashua City Hall, there's a bust of President Kennedy. That's because he was there in January of 1960, and it's one of the places where he sort of kicked off his run for the White House. He made a speech there at City Hall, and he obviously won the New Hampshire primary. He was kind of the only major candidate on the ballot at the time, although the fact that he won the primary does not necessarily mean that he was necessarily going to wind up as the nominee. There were several other big names, including the man who succeeded him as president, Lyndon Johnson, who were hoping to win that nomination that year. But certainly that was one of the springboards, and so Nashua has always felt that strong connection to President Kennedy. He had actually visited the state quite a few times before that. He had been in Exeter in 1956. That was after he had tried to become the Democratic vice presidential nominee for Adlai Stevenson. He was unsuccessful in that, but he came to Exeter shortly thereafter, hoping to do what politicians do to keep their name in the, you know, in voters' minds and to sort of stoke the fires about what may come 4 years later. And so so he has those connections to our state.
Yeah, that's interesting. So he was up here campaigning a fair bit, it sounds like, both in the 50s and in 1960. There are other stories too, right, Brady, about JFK and his connection to New Hampshire and issues in New Hampshire. When he was president, there was some issue on the Vermont-New Hampshire border.
There was, right. One of the last bills that President Kennedy signed before he came to Texas and was in the assassination was a bill that created what is probably the first interstate school district. It's the one that's still in existence today, Dresden Interstate School District between Hanover, New Hampshire, and Norwich, Vermont. The reason that the federal government had to get involved in that is because the Constitution says that states cannot enter into agreements with each other. So Congress passed a law saying that this school district would be all right, and then he signed that shortly before he headed to Texas.
Wow, that's one of those. I did not know that story. So that's great, Brady. And we're going to let you go because we know you've got a lot to do there. But just any other reflections or stories that you want to share with us when it comes to this Granite State observation and reflection on JFK?
Well, one of the little known stories about President Kennedy and New Hampshire is actually that there was an attempt made on, or there was going to an almost attempt on his life by a person who was living in New Hampshire. His name was Richard Paul Pavlik, and he lived in Belmont, New Hampshire. He had, after the election, had started stalking Kennedy as he was traveling around the country and had been sending these strange postcards from each of the places to the town postmaster in Belmont saying, "You will hear from me very soon." He had actually bought some dynamite, and his plan was to try and crash his car into Kennedy's car when he was in it to try and kill him before he took the oath of office. The postmaster in Belmont started to notice that these weird postcards were coming from places where the president-elect was staying and visiting, and he put two and two together and contacted law enforcement. So in a way, New Hampshire is very fortunate that that plot didn't happen, because some of the difficulties that Dallas has gone through over the last 3 years could have conceivably come on our state instead.
Holy smokes, Brady. All right. Well, stories that no doubt will be included in your forthcoming book. Thank you so much. Good luck today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Again, that's NHPR's Brady Carlson, our All Things Considered host. He's at Dealey Plaza in Dallas right now. Brady's working on a book with a potential title called Dead Presidents, An American Adventure. It's about his visits to presidential gravesites and how we honor our presidents. Jeff Feingold, you want to jump back real quick?
I just want to say something else about Kennedy's ties to New Hampshire is that, you know, in a lot of ways, he re-energized the Democratic Party in the 1960s and went into the 70s. After his election in 62, the Democrats had a governor, eventually had a congressman for a term or so, and a couple of senators eventually. And it was because of Kennedy's, JFK's ties also to the Dunphy family of New Hampshire, the Dunphy Hotel family, which had very close relationships with the Kennedys. And it's really an interesting thing to see how the influence he did and the family has had on New Hampshire.
Well, and probably more well-known as a senator in New Hampshire, as that neighboring
Absolutely.
State senator, we still see that dynamic
yes.
today. Let's take a call, gentlemen. This is Fred in Portsmouth. Hi, Fred. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Fred, are you with us? Go ahead. You're on the New Hampshire News Roundup. And we're having phone bugaboos today. I'm not sure what's going on. Thank you, Fred, for trying. Hope you call back. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Dean, I want to turn to you on this one. There was an interesting question that came up this week concerning voting procedures in an age of electronic sharing of everything. A candidate in Nashua put a picture of his ballot on Instagram. Now, what was that about, and why was that not the right thing to do?
It's interesting. This is actually an electoral question that has gone back, goes back to the 19th century. Yeah, Paul Shea was a candidate for alderman in Nashua, third ward of Nashua, and also the same was true. Now we're finding out for Diane Sheehan, who's who also actually won an aldermanic race for an at-large seat. Basically, both of them put up pictures of their ballot on Instagram, which is the photo sharing software that's very popular on social media, just showing that they had voted for themselves. It's sort of a fun thing to do. But historically, there have been concerns about this because, you know, for example, in the late 1800s, when patronage was very common among political machines, you needed to verify and confirm that you had voted for the person you were going to say you were going to vote for so that you could then reap whatever benefits. So historically, the concern
Wait. Yeah. You had to show that you voted for so-and-so so he could give you $10?
Exactly. So in the old days, when there was patronage for voting, you needed to be able to confirm that you voted. So a number of state constitutions prohibit showing photographic evidence of your vote. New Hampshire's statute is very vague. It may prohibit you showing your ballot before, but not after. There's been a lot of confusion. Now, Secretary of State Bill Gardner has said it's just generally you shouldn't do it. But there are a lot of examples of this on the web. So, it's sort of something that was done kind of for fun, has this sort of more serious historical roots and concerns about bribery and coercion.
Well, I'm kind of surprised, Jeff, that this hasn't come up before. I mean, people have been snapping photos on their iPhones and so forth and posting on Facebook or Instagram or wherever for couple of years now. I'm kind of surprised that this.
I know it is interesting, but you think about it, if you look at the legislature in particular, they've had their problems with social media over the last couple of years. So maybe politicians don't. You know, they're a little slow on the uptake on that stuff.
All right. Did you want to jump in on that at all, Ben?
No.
Okay. We're going to go to a call now, and we're hoping to hear from Fred in Portsmouth. Hi, Fred. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Listen, I was a 21-year-old science teacher when JFK was assassinated, and that the day of his death. I sat with friends and we were just floored. I can't tell you how it turned the world upside down, you know. It was so close to the missile crisis. So without even thinking, we all jumped in my old Volkswagen and zoomed down to Washington. We found a room in the Y for $250 for the night.
Wow.
To stay and fortified by a can of Franco-American spaghetti from a vending machine.
Oh, dear.
That was our breakfast, and we found ourselves at 16th Street as the funeral procession came by. And I'll tell you, I didn't know why I went down there, but at that moment, when the caisson came by and the riderless horse and clanking on the street, I realized he was dead at that instant.
Made it real
and
for you.
For some, as a young person, it was like I was suddenly older. I was suddenly older, you know?
Fred, were you living in New Hampshire at the time?
No, I wasn't. I was in Long Island. I hadn't gotten up here yet.
Yeah, too far a drive to D.C., but still kind of a haul.
Kind of a trip, right? And the way back, you know, we had no money for gas. So we actually got someone on the Jersey Turnpike to cash a $10 check for us, which I don't think you could do that today.
Hey, I have one last question for you, Fred, and thank you so much for sharing your remembrances. You said you were a 21-year-old science teacher. What did you tell your students?
At first, when the announcement came over, the PA system, you know, they just patched in Walter Cronkite and all that stuff. And I kind of thought it was a conservative Southerner who might have done it, you know. So I was talking about extremist politics, but what did I know? I didn't know that much, you know.
Well,
I didn't have that much to say.
Fred, thank you so much. It's a great story. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And gentlemen, we have just a couple minutes, and I did want to just recognize that New Hampshire has a new poet laureate, Alice Fogel. She was selected from a group of 17 poets nominated, and she's been said to have a wonderful literary reputation, known nationally, very well respected here in New Hampshire. We played a little piece of Alice Fogel at the beginning of the show. So I just want to recognize that and say congratulations to Alice Fogel. I also want to check in with all of you about what you might be looking at, following, working on next week. Ben Loopsdorf, what are you going to be tracking next week?
Well, Monday is the opening of the filing period for that special election we talked about earlier for Ray Burton's seat, the District 1 seat on the Executive Council. Filings will be taken at the Secretary of State's office Monday through Wednesday, and then the following Monday after Thanksgiving. So we talked about potential candidates. We talked about the scope of the race. But Monday is when we'll start to see who's actually getting in, who's getting out, and if there will be a primary. It looks like at this point there very well will be
given
on the Democratic
names, Dean,
side,
read, yeah.
at least. But that these seats, as we said, don't open up that often. So.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. And again, putting some new names out there. So, okay, Jeff, how about you?
Well, this is the time of year when we put together our annual preview issue for the end of the month in December, which looks at the economy from all different perspectives. And we start working on that in the next week or so. And that's when we talk to different people in different industries and different economists and find out exactly what is happening. So
I love those end of the year reviews, whether it's books or the economy or whatever.
Yeah,
so that's great.
We're hoping that it's a little bit brighter for 2014. So we'll see what happens.
That's what Dennis DeLay says.
That's right.
Well, and next week on The Exchange, we're going to dig into the debate over whether genetically modified food should be labeled. This is not just going on in New Hampshire. Obviously, this is happening around the country. I think they had a vote on this in Washington State recently. And the day before Thanksgiving, guys, we're going to have a lot of fun because, as you probably all know, it's also the first day of Hanukkah. Jeff Feingold, I don't know if I can say what people are saying.
Hanukkah,
Thanksgiving, Hanukkah. Anyway, we've got a great book on the history of the holiday, how American Jews have transformed it over the many, many years. That's what we're going to be doing next week. Dean, how about you?
Because we're getting into the holiday period now, there's going to be a little bit of a lull in terms of, legislative work and policy. But, whenever you get into the December before a midterm election year, the fields really start to solidify. So we're going to see what happens in that Senate race with Jeanne Shaheen. Everyone keeps saying some other Republicans are going to get in. Doesn't seem to be happening so far. Also, Annie Custer and Carol Shea Porter in the two congressional seats getting ready for that midterm election year. So I'm going to start to gear up with that.
Yeah, all right. Well, Dean, thank you, as always, very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure, Laura.
That's Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. His website is nhpoliticalcapital.com. Ben Lubsdorf, thank you very much for being here.
It's been a pleasure.
Ben Lubsdorf, staff reporter at the Concord Monitor, covering New Hampshire politics and state government. And Jeff Feingold, thanks also for your time. It was good to see you.
Thank you. It was great seeing you, Laura.
Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy. On The Exchange, we tap into the debate over whether genetically modified foods should be labeled in New Hampshire. Then a new book about the history of Hanukkah and how American Jews have transformed this ancient holiday. And we'll end the week with a conversation on the Affordable Care Act as we play back for you our virtual town hall event with the Live Free or Die Alliance. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange every morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
NHPR 958, and good morning. The domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup of the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from UR members. M from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, helping you create eco-friendly sleep environments. Also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. And Comcast Business supporting New Hampshire Food Bank's collection of non-perishable food items at the New Hampshire for the Holidays Expo, December 7th and 8th. More at events, nh.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ,
Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. In an historic shift, the Senate narrowly voted to eliminate use of the filibuster against nearly all presidential nominations. California became the seventh state to reject President Obama's insurance fix for canceled health care policy.